SPEP is savoring a new vision for its future. Rooted in our ongoing purpose and mission, we have a new vision that paints a picture of what we desire to be. A church where Jesus mends broken lives with the goodness of God and equips us to join him in his work. What will it take to become that kind of church? Well, before we talk about plans and organization, we need to think about values. In order for this to be a church known for Jesus mending broken lives with people being equipped to join him in the mending, we've got to develop a commitment to certain values. Every congregation is tied together with some collection of values, stated or unstated. And I know that we could easily write down 50 or more values that would be appropriate for us. But your session has chosen 6, which we believe are especially relevant for a vision like ours. They flow more or less out of the vision itself. The first value represents something crucial in our understanding of the word church. It describes a balance that is absolutely essential for Christ's church in the 21st century. Our first value is firm in biblical standards, flexible in ministry style. Firm in biblical standards, flexible in ministry style. Our text is in the book of 1 Corinthians, chapter 9. I'll start in verse 19 and read down to verse 22. These are words of the Apostle Paul, the Word of God. Though I am free and belong to no man, I make myself a slave to everyone to win as many as possible. To the Jews, I became like a Jew to win the Jews. To those under the law, I became like one under the law, though I myself am not under the law, so as to win those under the law. To those not having the law, I became like one not having the law, though I am not free from God's law, but I'm under Christ's law, so as to win those not having the law. To the weak, I became weak to win the weak. I have become all things to all men so that by all possible means I might save some. In the letter we call 1 Corinthians, the Apostle Paul wrote to the church in Corinth concerning a number of congregational issues and concerns. And one of those concerns had to do with whether Christians ought to purchase meat from animals that had been sacrificed at the local pagan temples. Some Christians understood that since these pagan idols didn't actually exist, there was no spiritual stain on the meat. But others were worried that the meat was somehow tainted by its association and Christians had no business buying it. Now, in chapter 8 of this letter, just the chapter before this, Paul clearly teaches that indeed there is nothing wrong with this meat and Christians are perfectly free to eat it. In other words, the conscience problems that some Christians had with eating this meat did not bind the consciences of the other Christians. Paul knew, for example, that these pagan deities did not exist, and he would not allow the conscience of some baby Christians to limit what he did in private. In fact, Paul worked very hard to educate the consciences of baby Christians to help them find freedom from old superstitions and old ways of thinking. However, there was a larger principle involved. And that is how Christians use the spiritual freedom they've been given in Christ. Christians are free from being limited by the weaknesses of others. But they're more free than that. They are also free to limit themselves out of kindness and respect for others who are less mature, in hope of eventually teaching them a better way. He says in chapter 8, be careful. Be careful that the exercise of your freedom does not become a stumbling block to the weak. If Paul were hosting some baby Christians who thought eating meat offered to idols was sinful, Paul wouldn't serve them that kind of meat. Paul would willingly adapt his practice. He would limit himself on that occasion for the sake of his Christian brother. Paul would eat such meat in private or when dining with other mature Christian friends, but not when dining with baby Christians whose consciences he would violate. They were just learning to put God first, even though they barely knew what that meant. They were trying, and Paul wouldn't want to do anything to get in the way of that tender faith. Now, in our text, chapter 9, Paul expands on those ideas. He's coming out of that discussion, and he's applying those ideas to dealing with non-Christians in an effort to introduce them to Christ. If a baby Christian is spiritually weak, how much weaker is an unbeliever, somebody who doesn't know Christ? Verse 19, though I am free and I belong to no man, I make myself a slave to everyone to win as many as possible. If it is necessary to voluntarily limit my freedom for the sake of baby Christians to help them grow in the faith, then how much more is it necessary to limit my freedom for the sake of unbelievers? How much more careful must I be not to allow insignificant matters of culture and taste to get in the way of communicating the gospel? Concerning his private life, Paul did not feel in any way personally bound by a non-Christian's beliefs or customs. Verse 19, he's very clear about it. I am free. I belong to no man. Even if the whole society around him insisted on a certain lifestyle or whatever, Paul would not become a slave to any pressure to conform. Paul belonged to Christ. I'm free. I belong to no man. But because Paul was free to belong to Christ alone, he was therefore free to exalt Christ alone and to follow Christ alone. And the risen Christ desires to reach all kinds of people. The risen Jesus desires to reach people who do not yet know the Lord, and their lives show it. Their lives are dominated by cultures that are spiritually confused, blind. Their lives are littered by traditions and peer group pressures which they think are of the highest importance. They may pay no attention to the fact they're going to die and stand before God, but they're very much focused on making sure that their clothing is just in the right fashion, the right style, cut, so on. And these things are relatively insignificant compared to the gospel. But that's the point. If they're so insignificant, then we must not allow them to become the focus of attention, because if we do, the message of Jesus could be lost. So though I am free and I belong to no man, I make myself a slave to everyone. I adapt. I put on the culture like a garment so people aren't so distracted by my appearance that they miss my message. Though I am free and I belong to no man, I make myself a slave to everyone to win as many as possible. Now, for Paul, this meant a lot of personal compromise. As he's very clear in all of his letters, no compromise when it comes to the gospel message, but plenty of compromise when it comes to the way he lives and his habits and so on. It says in verse 20, to the Jews, I became like a Jew, to win the Jews. Paul grew up in a Gentile culture. He was, we would say, cosmopolitan. He spoke several languages. He was educated. He was traveled. And Paul had been liberated from the heavy burden of Pharisaical legalism. Christ showed him that salvation was explained. It was revealed by a Jewish culture which was no longer mandatory. No longer was godliness experienced through food regulations and elaborate rituals. All those customs taught principles of godliness. In Christ, those training wheels could be left behind. Paul loved the freedom of that, to come out from behind the Jewish cultural walls, to touch other societies and touch other people and eat whatever he liked and to practice godliness by engaging the world rather than being shut off from it. But when Paul was presenting Christ to Jews, all those freedoms would just get in the way. The Jews, I'm talking about non-Christian Jews, would be too busy being offended by the way he was ignoring the ancient traditions of his people to listen to the message of Christ. So when he was with non-Christian Jews, Paul ate kosher, he cut his hair, he took vows, he visited the temple, he did all the things that Jews did. He wasn't pretending to be Jewish, he was Jewish. He was simply choosing to limit his Christian freedom in an effort to win Jews to Christ. Let's not talk about that stuff. Let's talk about Christ. Verse 21, to those not having the law, I became like one not having the law, so as to win those not having the law. The flip side is the way that Paul left his Jewishness behind when dealing with Gentiles. And that too was a sacrifice. You see, while Paul was free from having to live under the Jewish code, that doesn't mean he didn't appreciate it. Paul grew up in a Jewish home with Jewish celebrations and rituals that were part of his childhood, part of his upbringing. I mean, you don't like Christmas trees because of some theological argument. You like them because you grew up with them and they remind you of family and they just kind of feel right at Christmas time. Paul had many such traditions that just felt right for him, but he was willing to leave them aside when dealing with Gentiles. He could have recited some beloved Jewish prayers before a meal, but he would refrain if that would make a new Gentile friend uncomfortable. The way he ate, the way he dressed, the way he talked, he tried to blend in. So the radical message of Christ would have front stage, and no cultural faux pas would be allowed to steal the show from behind. For Paul, it was the same principle he had just discussed with regard to dealing with baby Christians, only now it's applying it to non-Christians. Those outside of Christ may be wonderfully talented, successful, intelligent, competent, but they are spiritually weak. Separated from God, their spiritual eyes are weak. Their awareness of God, their appreciation of the life God designed, and their own imminent danger, very weak. So he says in verse 22, "To the weak, I became weak to win the weak. I've become all things to all men that by all possible means I might save some." Is there any principle more challenging for Christian missionaries than this? Years ago in our first church, Mickey spoke once with a dear fellow, a missionary for many years in Africa. And he remarked to Mickey how difficult it was for him to get people he was working with to sit on the church benches that he had built. They just perversely wanted to sit on the ground. And he was afraid that he might have to take those benches out sometime, but he was going to go back and give them one more try. Try to get the locals to sit on the benches like they should when they're in church. Now, those were the days of Christian compounds where missionaries would live in as isolated a community as they could, recreating a little piece of America or Europe as best as possible. And I don't wish for a minute to criticize the zeal of those wonderful missionaries. I admire their devotion to Christ. I admire their sacrifice. But I do wonder whether they really capture the spirit of what Paul's talking about here. And I realize that's easy for me to say. But I must ask whether Paul is teaching here something that missionaries need to learn. Certainly, missions organizations are much more conscious of these things today. It's much more common to see Americans working hard to fit in to the places of service where they are. Julie Soltis' home is a refuge for refugees. The Lloyds have adopted a Latvian child. The Van Horns work hard to support their son in a Moldovan school. Examples could go on and on. Over the years, we are painfully learning that while the gospel is American, it is not exclusively or preferentially American. The gospel transcends all cultures. It is as thoroughly Russian as it is Chinese, as it is American. And one day, it shall be as thoroughly Iranian and Saudi as it is American. It will. The gospel was here long before America or England or the Anglo-Saxons and the Celts. The gospel was revealed through one culture, that of ancient Israel. And with Christ, that model of that culture has been laid aside, but its lessons now are common property available to every culture to share. And those lessons form a transcendent truth, a truth that rises above any and all cultures, a truth about the nature of God, the infinite, personal, and perfect Creator, the truth about the essential brokenness of all humanity, the radical brokenness of humanity, and a redemption, a radical redemption equal to our brokenness, and the truth about an eternal partnership and family that God is forming with a renewed humanity defined by faith in Jesus Christ. And you can discuss that truth over chow mein, and you can discuss that truth over roasted insects, and you can discuss that truth over split pea soup. You can discuss it face-to-face or read it in books or talk about it over the internet. You can sing about it with Congo drums or tin whistles or a full Western orchestra. And Paul is saying here what a shame it would be if any of us were to insist that it could only be discussed in the garb of just one of those little cultures, our culture, and nobody else's. Oh, the gospel would still spread, but it would take longer. It'd have to make its way over all the barriers we create. That would be a shame. Because all kinds of people need Christ, all kinds of people. And nothing should get in the way of the battle. I make myself a slave to everyone to win as many as possible. I become all things to all men so that by all possible means I might save some. And this is a message that all missionaries need to learn. So why am I preaching it to you? Why am I preaching it to us? You know the answer. Because we are missionaries. Now, Christian, When I suggest to you that we are all missionaries, I do not mean today what pastors often mean when they say that. I'm not talking about how we're all part of the Great Commission. I'm not talking about how we all need to support sending folks overseas to preach Christ in foreign places. I'm not even talking exactly about how we must share the gospel with our own friends and neighbors, people like ourselves who live around us. I'm assuming that, but that's not my point. My point is that this lesson of Paul's is important to us because you and I are missionaries in the more restricted sense of being sent by God cross-culturally to reach people of another culture. Oh, that may sound very strange. I just said that Christ calls us to be cross-cultural missionaries. Am I actually suggesting that we should all quit our jobs, sell our homes, and move to some other culture to share Christ? Of course not. Of course not. Because we don't have to sell our homes and move away. See, usually missionaries have to leave home and go elsewhere to be immersed in a different culture, but not us. In our case, different cultures have come here. I'm not talking about foreigners or students who are visiting the U.S. and let's reach them before they go home. I'm saying that our culture, our home, is changing around us. Our society has done the moving. So just by staying where we are, we're becoming immersed in a different culture. And therefore, if we want to win as many as possible, we must learn to think as cross-cultural missionaries. If you are over 30, haven't you been feeling a kind of an inverted culture shock? I mean, people who travel to other cultures go through what they call culture shock, right? Everybody's talking a different language or talking about different things and have different habits. And it's not that the differences are all bad or anything. It's just there's so many of them. It's disorienting. It's threatening. It's called culture shock. Haven't you been feeling it here? Restaurants starting to take pesos as well as dollars. The economy's different. A woman and an African-American running for president? Politics is different. Gay rights slowly becoming American law? Public morals becoming different. Ben Stein recently complained on national television he had no clue who Nick and Jessica were and he didn't care. He'd noticed a change in what people were talking about. I can't get used to the phrase, no problem. It's very hard for me. In a restaurant, every time I ask a server for something or thank them for something, they say, no problem. Whatever happened to certainly, sir, or you're welcome, or something like that. People are talking differently than I'm used to, and I got to get used to it so that it becomes no problem. Christians are experiencing culture shock today from at least two sources. On the one hand, our culture is changing because it is becoming post-Christian. Now, that does not mean that people are necessarily resistant to Christ. It means that the traditional Western values, which were largely shaped by biblical truth, are losing ground as a norm for our institutions. Biblical values are no longer the norm for our families in this country or our schools or our courts. Biblical values are no longer the norm for a great many churches as well. And that change has been going on under the surface of our society for many decades. It's now broken to the surface, and things are starting to change openly. And there's a lot more to come. There's a lot of inertia built up. There's a sort of a cultural inertia that's going to continue to change for some time. As an illustration, last week's UN report on global warming said that even if we brought carbon dioxide levels down 70 to 80% overnight, we would still experience the effects of global warming for years to come. In a similar way, even if our culture stopped becoming more pluralistic overnight, which it won't, but even if it did, the cultural shifts that have already begun will continue to change culture for years. Decades to come. So one way culture is changing is that it's becoming post-Christian in its institutions. Another way our culture is changing is the speed in which new generations are changing in the way they think and live compared to their parents. That has not always been the case in world history. For most of world history, one generation looked pretty much like the one before. But at least since the beginning of the 20th century, generational change has been speeding up, I'd say exponentially, partly due to the unprecedented impact of changing technology. Industry, transportation, medicine, communication have changed society big time. You of the greatest generation might recall how families were changed forever when teenagers first got access to their own car. The world changed with the invention of the automobile assembly line. Today, it's the independence of a cell phone and internet chat and a lot of money to spend. So not only has the culture changed around our homes, it has changed inside our homes. Not only must we relate to a different society out there, but we must also struggle to communicate with our own children. So you see, Christians, we are missionaries. Not only in the general sense of having a part in the Great Commission, but in the specific sense of having to reach out to Christ, for Christ, across cultures. We don't have to move somewhere else. Somewhere else has moved in all around us. So how do we apply the principle that Paul outlines in this text? Our response as a church is encapsulated in the first of six values that undergird our vision. Our vision is to be a church where Jesus mends broken lives with the goodness of God and equips us to join him in his work. In order to become that, we must have as our first value to be firm in biblical standards and to be flexible in ministry style. We must be firm in biblical standards. If the gospel is transcendent, if it transcends every culture, including our own, then we must be crystal clear about what it is. Clarity of the gospel is perhaps the greatest strength of our Reformed tradition. And while the standards we use, the Westminster Confession of Faith and Catechisms, are rooted in 17th century England, they are wonderful works that summarize the great truths of the Bible. Now, as you know, we don't require adherence to those standards for church membership. We do ask everybody to attend a membership class, partly because we want you to know what you and your family will be taught. But all we require for membership is a basic testimony of faith and a promise to honor the government of the church. In contrast, I spend the whole year working with officer candidates through our confession because we do require affirmation of those standards for our leaders. They take vows before God. Adherence to our standards locks us down to an excellent formulation of biblical truth so we won't drift with the latest theological winds and whims. We don't claim that our standards are perfect, and we must remain open to genuine biblical reform. But we would rather have excellent standards of biblical truth, even if they're imperfect, rather than no standards at all. Churches who do not enforce biblical standards may find it easier to adapt to the changing culture, but they lose the gospel message that any and every culture needs to hear. Being firm in biblical standards is half of the first value we intend to cherish. The other half is being flexible in ministry style. Now, to some extent, SPEP has always tried to adapt to our culture that way. That's why we chose a blended service from the very beginning. Our music has always been a mix of Reformation hymns and contemporary songs and gospel music, spiced with some classical, folk, and other kinds. This has allowed generations to worship together, enjoy what they enjoy, and graciously appreciate what others, older or younger, enjoy. And we've tried to be sensitive to the fact that many churched people leave the religion that they're used to when they actually find Christ and they're looking for more meat. Some come here and they're used to more formal settings in the past and they find us refreshingly informal, while those from less formal settings come and we bring them a heightened sense of liturgy. Several years ago, we changed the format of our worship service to emphasize a single theme. Because the fragmentation of our society is so bad, we didn't want our religion to feel fragmented too. So we changed to a single theme service. It's kind of subtle. We don't trumpet it, but it's there. Every worship service explores one idea. If you were to attend both services some Sunday, you'd start to notice the pattern once you'd gone through it once. You would see a pattern woven throughout. Today, for example, we have been exploring the idea of Reformation, how we need to always adapt our practices to communicate an unchanging truth to a changing society. Oh, that's why we sang Mighty Fortress. Oh, that's why those ideas were there in the various prayers. Recently, we changed our worship again, realizing that for many people in our society, church is becoming more entertainment than worship. And realizing that many people, especially young folks, are searching for liturgical roots, and frankly, just being convicted by God that it's right, we have included one sacrament in almost every service. So we have shown some flexibility in the past to accommodate the gospel to Christians and to churched people who come out of this culture. What this text makes us ask, though, is what kind of flexibility do we need in order to reach unchurched people that Jesus is seeking? See, SBEP attracts those who are moving into the area and looking for a good church. SBEP attracts people who are dissatisfied with the church they're at and they want something more. SBEP attracts those who have a church background and they know there's more and they come here and they find Christ. But what about all those unchurched folks that Jesus is planning to reach over the next 10 years? Can we have any part of that? What about the next generation? What about folks of any age who've had no significant experience with church, or what they had was minimal and negative? Could we become equipped to join Jesus in reaching them? Or is Jesus just going to have to use somebody else in the area? I make myself a slave to everyone to win as many as possible. I've become all things to all men, so that by all possible means I might save some. Do you feel that way? Do I? Just how flexible are we prepared to be? Paul tells us we don't have to personally prefer our culture's changes or adopt them in the way we live, but we cannot allow our preferences to hinder outreach to people who are different from us. Not if we care about winning as many as possible. And that's something I do care about. Don't you? If we embrace this vision to be a church where Jesus is mending broken lives and equips us to join him in his work, then that equipping has got to train us to be firm in biblical standards and flexible in ministry style. Of the two, I think that this church will have an easier time remaining firm in biblical standards. The question is, can we become sufficiently flexible in our ministry style? I know we're going to keep our doors open to people who already know that they need the mending Jesus can give. But what about people who only know that they're broken? And perhaps they're only barely aware of that. Will we be willing to adapt so that our cultural differences are not the issue? And they can see the gospel for what it is and see Jesus for who he is? I can't answer that question. That's a question we can only answer as a congregation as we consider our future. But I know what Paul would say. He would tell us to be firm in our biblical standards about the gospel and flexible in our ministry style, becoming all things to all men that we might save some.